Support for the Capital Connection comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, uupinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustina. Joining us this week is Lauren DeRosier. She is an assistant professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic at Albany Law School. And before focusing on her career in immigration, Lauren was a litigation associate at a large law firm in New York City, representing clients in civil matters in state and federal courts while maintaining an active immigration pro bono docket. She received her JD from the University of Michigan Law School and BA from Bard College at Simon's Rock. Lauren DeRosier, welcome back to the Capital Connection.
Thanks so much for having me. Delighted to be here.
Well, before we kind of get into the serious subject of immigration, tell us a little more, just to remind our listeners, about what the Immigration Law Clinic at Albany Law is and what you do.
So I have the best job in the entire world. I not only get to practice immigration law, so representing people who aren't able to afford a private immigration attorney in a daily practice, but I also get to teach. And so I have every semester law students who join the clinic. They enroll in the clinic for academic credit, and they get an intensive experience where they get to be kind of the frontline attorneys or student interns working on a case. So they get real client contact under very intensive supervision of myself and the senior staff attorney who works with me. And they really do a phenomenal job every semester. And we get to help a lot of people who otherwise wouldn't be able to have access to immigration and legal representation.
Well, and it's true, right, that so many immigrants, many who are trying to become citizens of this country, are disadvantaged themselves, right? They're poor. In many cases, they're doing jobs which many Americans don't want to do. And so in many ways, they need a leg up.
There's a whole range of folks who need immigration legal representation. It's very difficult. It's a very confusing system. And if you have an immigration attorney, either in kind of an affirmative visa-seeking posture or if you are in removal proceedings, which is kind of deportation proceedings, having an attorney can really make the difference in your case. There's not enough legal representation in general for immigrants, especially in upstate New York, especially in the capital region. And if you aren't able to afford an attorney, it makes it that much more difficult.
Well, Lauren DeRosier from the Immigration Law Clinic at Albany Law School. There's a climate of fear right now. I don't think there's any question about it when it comes to immigrants or migrants. The federal government under the Trump administration has created that fear by saying we're going to crack down and in some cases going into courthouses and other sensitive places to grab people, grabbing people off the street, stereotyping people by the way they look and the way they speak. And in many cases, arresting the wrong people. We've seen the murder in Minnesota. And this all comes down to how will the states handle the federal government when ICE comes in, for example, to New York? And to that end, we have an agreement. Lawmakers have made a deal to rein in police collaboration with ICE. However, it doesn't ban informal cooperation. There's a number of parts to this legislation. In general, what's in your mind, Lauren, about how things are going here?
I'm really excited to see progress at the New York State level. I think this is the first time in a while that some of the pieces of legislation that immigrant advocates have really been pushing for have really made progress. It's not quite at the place where we had wanted to see. So New York for All had been a more comprehensive proposed potential bill that was not adopted, but a lot of the operative pieces are at least in effect, or will be in effect with what has been passed. I think big things are the banning of 287G agreements. So the formal contracts between local law enforcement and ICE, so it co-opts local law enforcement to enforce civil immigration law. I often analogize this to, it would be like making your local Albany Police Department go out and enforce federal tax law. So kind of co-opting them for the use by the IRS. This would be that the 287G agreements are kind of the same thing, where they co-opt what should be the kind of criminal enforcement and criminal law enforcement by local police into a civil immigration enforcement that's wholly different from what their job usually should entail. That is a big, big piece of progress. And I think that the work of a lot of advocates and a lot of the representatives who have been working on this really should be applauded. The other things that I think we're seeing that I'm excited by in the legislation is the sensitive locations prohibition. So before the Trump administration, before 2025, ICE had a policy that prohibited enforcement at what was called sensitive locations. So those are places like churches or schools, places that are assumed to be community places where we wouldn't want to disrupt the normal functions because they have such significant value to society as a whole. The Trump administration, back in January of 2025, rescinded that policy. And that's why we are suddenly seeing, over the past year and a half, a lot of enforcement at places like churches or schools, that elementary schools, for instance.
Hospitals.
The hospitals, which I think is just so, so incredibly horrifying, of being in a situation where you need medical care and having to make a choice about whether that is a safe thing for you to do. I think that's inhuman. But the New York State legislation will hopefully do a lot in preventing enforcement in those locations. So the legislation effectively codifies at the state level what was protected by that ICE policy. And I think another kind of the other thing that I am excited to see is the piece that prevents law enforcement from wearing masks in public. I think that that's something that has been a notable piece of the immigration enforcement over the past year and a half that has been very troubling for myself and I think many people in seeing federal immigration officers from ICE, from CBP, people with tactical gear and weapons who are masked and who don't identify themselves. I think that, and I think most people agree with me on this, that's a really new thing that we have seen in the past year and a half that is makes it difficult to hold anybody accountable. And I think that the images are elicit a certain reaction, and that reaction is part of the purpose of wearing masks. So I am excited to see that the legislation will prohibit that. I think that there will likely be challenges to some of this from the federal side. But I am hopeful that our friends who are federal litigators are prepared, and I'm sure that they will do a great job, and the state will do a great job of defending what I think is really important pieces of law.
We're speaking with Lauren DeRosier. She is an assistant professor and the director of the Immigration Law Clinic at Albany Law School. The, again, climate of fear. You know, just in your own interaction and, you know, the students who are helping run the clinic, you got to believe that the goal has been achieved. If the Trump administration wanted to slow down immigration, one of the chief ways to slow it down is to create fear. And within the country, I wonder how many people are less likely to seek out your help just because they don't want to leave their house.
I think that that's something that I have heard anecdotally, that people are really afraid to leave their house, to get groceries, to, you know, go see their attorney. That, you know, going outside is now a much bigger risk than it used to be. And I think that that is horrific to be in that situation. And I think it is a huge loss for our society that we are forcing people to make those calculations when they are trying to determine how to keep themselves and their families safe.
Not to mention the ripple effect, if you think about it, Lauren, because the census is another big area where we want to count everyone in the country, including people who are here not legally or awaiting their citizenship. So if you're of mind that the less people to vote, the more likely your party wins, you could also see why that strategy would work for the Trump administration.
And that has been a move that the administration has made in the past. It's trying not to count non-citizens, and the ACLU did a fantastic job of litigating that in front of the Supreme Court. But I am certain that that will continue to be a hot topic.
Speaking of a hot topic, the issue of Nurul Amin Shah Alam, this is a refugee from Myanmar in Erie County, who was picked up by Border Patrol and left outside at a Tim Hortons parking lot a cold winter night in Buffalo and died. And that has pushed, I think, many lawmakers in New York to end up with this legislation under which New Yorkers will be able to sue federal immigration authorities for alleged civil rights violations. However, it hasn't stopped. This legislation doesn't stop the initial thing, which is preventing ICE from picking up someone like this and leaving them in the cold.
I think that the attempt to provide some sort of after-the-fact accountability does change the calculus that the federal agencies will have to make. I agree. I don't think that it will prevent the mistreatment and maltreatment of people in custody in ICE detention. There's a large detention facility in Batavia, the Buffalo Federal Detention Facility, that holds many of the people who are detained in upstate New York. And there have been allegations of pretty horrific treatment, including medical treatment, medical neglect out of that facility. That's something that is endemic to many ICE facilities. For instance, Delaney Hall and the hunger strikes there and the protests there are really sparking. And they are in response to kind of a widespread mistreatment of people in ICE detention.
I don't know about you, Lauren DeRosier, from the Immigration Law Clinic at Albany Law School, but it seems to me there are going to be lawsuits tying up a lot of cases. For example, the legislative package that we're talking about, immigration-wise, would create an Office of Immigrant Trust, a branch of the Attorney General's Office that will investigate complaints of violations and potentially sue or monitor violators. You know, things often end up in lawsuits, and then that gets tangled up and delays time and often years beyond when the rights were taken away and does little to relieve the people who were hurt.
I agree. And I think that with kind of the rise of the emergency docket at the Supreme Court and interlocutory appeals, so cases that are heard before the appellate courts, even though they aren't finished yet. Normally, appellate courts will wait until a case is fully completed at the lower trial courts before they will take the case. But the emergency docket or what is known as the shadow docket at the Supreme Court has led to a rise in the court hearing cases very early on, including things for like injunctive relief, which is when one party is trying to prevent something from going into effect usually. And I think that has led to a conception in our culture that things happen really quickly in courts. Sometimes they do. Sometimes they happen very, very quickly. But most of the time, including for most federal suits, they take years. Sometimes they take decades. And the people who have been harmed at the end of the day very rarely see any sort of recompense in any timely manner, if they see that at all.
Lauren, I've been speaking on a regular basis with the folks over at New York Focus, which is an investigative journalistic independent media organization, and they've been looking into immigration. I've cited a few bits of information from one of their articles on the current deal we've been talking about in New York, but they've also talked to me about the issue of reuniting children with families and given examples of a family in Brooklyn. They were waiting on their children to get to the States, and the children were brought in, but they weren't able to reunite for a long time. There was paperwork that had to be filled out, all sorts of forms and IDs submitted, and once they cleared all that, there was a delay, and then they had to do it all over again. And the children were less than 10 miles away from their parents. And when one of the parents was sent to pick them up, they were detained. So the complications of this reach to trying to even reunite children with their families.
I think that it can be incredibly difficult, especially for people who have mixed immigration status in their families. So if parents maybe don't have immigration status and children might be U.S. citizens, making those arrangements and keeping families united can be incredibly challenging. One thing that folks can always do is try to plan ahead. I know it's not always possible, but to the extent that families are able to plan ahead, identify people who in an emergency would be able to potentially step in as temporary guardians and take care of children or pets or other family members who might need additional assistance, to the extent that folks are able to plan ahead, that can make a real difference. But it is incredibly challenging. There is an increasing rise of family detention. So children who are being detained with their family members in ICE custody, mostly in Dilley, Texas, and the allegations of treatment there of the children and of the families is just really heartbreaking because, as we were talking about before, there are many allegations of mistreatment in ICE detention generally. And then specifically to see the impact that that has on children is horrific.
Yeah, it certainly is, at least the anecdotal evidence that we're getting. And we're seeing so many of these immigrants warehoused, as you said, in these detention centers. And to me, you know, it says so much about how we feel about these human beings. And they are human beings, and yet we seem to be treating them lesser than in the way that we hold them captive. And, you know, there is a real issue with housing migrants or immigrants when they come to your community. And people get concerned, but I think a lot of it has to do with fear of the other. And when the government promotes fear, that doesn't help us solve any problems, especially when so many, I would say most of the immigrants or migrants who come here do so wanting an opportunity, wanting to work, to get money to their families if they're back in a foreign location. So, you know, aren't we talking about basic human rights in the end?
Absolutely. And I think that the way that the current immigration system addresses immigration enforcement more broadly is itself subject to a lot of criticism in treating people like they are not people. And I think that the rise of immigration detention contractors like Geo Group and Core Civic, in which the number of people who can be detained increases profit and people are profit and dollar signs instead of human beings, is significantly detrimental. And the fear mongering that the current administration is doing. There was a recent law enforcement bulletin out of Colorado on counterterrorism from Colorado Network of Law Enforcement that warned that the current social media postings of the Department of Homeland Security and the White House can potentially be giving rise to white supremacy and encouraging anti-immigrant violence. And I think that, you know, there is a very real danger of this sort of attitude getting further entrenched into the federal immigration enforcement system. And so I am hopeful that the more people who are aware of it, who see this, who are willing to say something, the more people who are exposed to the deep, ugly pits of the system will change things not only for the current administration, but in future administrations as well.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that we're supposed to be a melting pot certainly doesn't follow under this current administration. And I think it goes a step further. Lauren, I wonder what you think. And that is when it comes to racism. You know, even the Trump administration have said they prefer immigrants from, you know, places like Scandinavia. You know, bring all the people you want from Norway or Western Europe, where we notice that the color of their skin is more white than the black and brown folks they seem to want to push out that come from more southerly regions of the world.
Absolutely. And I think that entrenched racism extends beyond just this administration. It, in many ways, goes deep into the historical roots of immigration law. But I think that it is exploited and the extent of it really expanded by this administration. And I think we can see that in, you know, how the administration has shut down refugee admissions, with the exception of, you know, white Afrikaners from South Africa, meaning that people from pretty much any other part of the world are not being resettled in the United States through the UN refugee admission system. I think with the quote-unquote pause on processing of people and immigration applications from certain countries, if you look at where those countries are, you know, those are countries in Africa and like the Middle East and South America. And I think goes even further with current statements made by, for instance, the Department of State in noting that their purpose is not to manage migration, but to foster what they call quote-unquote re-migration, which originates from, you know, 1930s Germany and the Nazi expulsion of Jewish people from Germany. And so the racism is not subtle, and it is growing increasingly extreme.
Yeah, well, we're running out of time. I just wanted to ask you, as someone who directs the Immigration Law Clinic at Albany Law School, what your advice is. I know the situations are unique and you're probably doing a case-by-case basis, but if you were to offer advice to folks who are immigrants in New York right now and maybe listening to this program, how should they be thinking about this? What should they be doing? How should they get in touch if it's not with you, with organizations that can help?
If you're not able to get in touch with an attorney to discuss your personal circumstances, there are nevertheless often resources that you can go to. So, for instance, the New York Immigration Coalition, or NYIC, has a plethora of resources available for folks, regardless of whether it is Know Your Rights, so that people know what their rights are when they are interacting with ICE, or if it's family preparedness and making sure that people are ready or have done some thinking about who can, for instance, take care of their kids if something should happen to them. They are a great resource. NYIC is a great resource for a lot of those materials. In addition, there are a lot of local organizations and local networks that do a lot of really terrific work with people directly in the community. For example, Columbia County Sanctuary Movement, or CCSM, in the Upper Hudson Valley and Capital Region does some really great work, as does the Capital Region Sanctuary Coalition. And they have an online presence on social media and websites. And I think that to the extent that people are able to provide any assistance, whether that is time or money, I would encourage people to look towards their local grassroots organization, because any dollars and any assistance is going to go a lot further with the folks who are used to pinching pennies to get the work done than in larger, maybe more national organizations. But I think that the place that I always look to for encouragement is what folks are doing themselves and on the ground. And I think that both CCSM and the Capital Region Sanctuary Coalition are really great examples of how people can organize and protect themselves. And I think that they are both really doing fantastic work.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. Our guest has been Lauren DeRosier. She is an assistant professor and the director of the Immigration Law Clinic at Albany Law School. And Lauren, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to talk about this very important issue impacting our society today.
Thanks so much for taking the time to address this topic.
Support for the Capital Connection comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.